But with the pandemic was the first time I abandoned getting a haircut. So since the pandemic has happened, I happen to have recently bought a good pair of clippers. And so I just go out in the backyard, set it to number one half, and just go over the top of my head and let the little pieces of hair fall into my garden, which I call feeding the birds.
You feed the birds.
That's interesting. Is there any farming benefit to having follicles in your soil? Or is it just a bunch of DNA that people are going to later on think, like, I think someone was murdered here over and over again. Very hairy
Yeah.
person. All right. Hello and welcome to Bald Talk, the podcast that has bald comedians interviewing bald radio hosts, podcasters, comedians, media bigwigs, and really anyone who is bald about being bald. I am Brian Baldsky.
And I'm Charlie Balders.
See what we did there? Which I wrote in there, and it's a hilarious
that was funny.
joke. See?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, I still got it. I still have
it. You still got it all these years later.
All these pandemic years later. And Charlie, today's guest is pretty much everything I listed in the show intro. Fast Company called him the most important person in entertainment you've never heard of and the Zelig of modern culture.
Wow, that's
yeah,
nice.
That's a big tray to carry. He is familiar to your ears for his nationally syndicated public radio interview show, Bullseye. He is the co-host of the podcast Jordan Jesse Go and Judge John Hodgman. He founded and is the owner of the not evil podcast media empire Maximum Fun. And he at times has one of the more noteworthy beards and mustache combinations I've ever seen. Please welcome
Agreed.
America's sweetheart and fellow baldy, Jesse Thorne.
Jesse Thorne, welcome to Bald
Thanks,
Talk.
Guys.
Yeah.
It's thrilled to be here.
It's lovely
Good
to
to
see
have
you.
You.
I'd say your mustache and beard is it's a little calmer right now, but it's still a pretty serious mustache.
It's fucking killer still.
Yeah.
The mustache is grand. Well, here's the thing. I have a little bit of thinness, the corners of my mouth and the beard. My beard is actually a little thin all around, but I got a special thinness in the corners of my mouth. I started growing out my stash to cover that. Then I was like, why not go whole hog?
Wait,
yeah,
so
totally.
you have a widow's peak in your stash zone?
Yeah, I basically have a stash, widow stash peak.
Wow.
I have a little bit of a widow's stash peak also, like these little corners here. For our listeners, I'm indicating the corners of my mouth.
Yes.
Yeah, basically the drool areas.
Drool zone.
Yeah. The frown or smile tuggers. Interesting. I wonder that I'm just going to start a theory that balding can spread to the beard area then. Based on no science.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It starts at the sides of the mouth.
And also it starts with misinformation, so I'm just going to put that out there for everybody. But yeah, you might be our first ghost.
We've had a couple ghosts on.
Yeah, they're pretty forthcoming. They have a lot to
it's
share.
It's interesting, yeah.
So you're bold. Obviously
a lot
more
of trouble recording them because of the chain rattling.
Right.
I know, yeah.
And they'll just pass
Marley
through the microphone. They'll lean into the mic and just fall through it, and they don't even know it.
Those ghost humor folks.
Yeah. But, you know, you're an interviewer, and we're interviewing you, so just resist the urge to turn the tables on us.
Oh, don't worry about it. I love talking about myself. I hate interviewing people.
Wow.
That's just how you make a living.
Yeah.
It's kind of a burden I took on when I was 19 and haven't been able to shake.
You can't turn back.
I love being the forum for you to just like put out there. It's like, oh, I hate my life, my career. Here it comes. Move over, Marc Maron. But anyway, bald hairs, not on the head. They're gone. When did it start for you?
I mean, I anticipated it. My dad was bald, and my mother's father was pretty bald. I think I started noticing, I wasn't like an adolescent balding person, but I think I started noticing it when I was in my, you know, when I was 22 or 23, something like that.
Right.
And I was bald enough to cut off my, like, to go with short hair by the time I was 30, I would say.
Yeah.
How old are you now, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't mind. I'm 40 years old. Recently turned
okay.
40
yeah,
years
I'm 42.
Old.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, I could have held out. Could have done some sweeping up top, but yep. I just said, I have dignity. I'm just gonna cut it short and let it be what it is.
Yeah, you're one of our rare guests that says that, because that's what I did. I was like 23 or 4 is when I was like, okay, it's definitely going. And the second I knew it was definitely going, I just shaved my head. And
have never yeah, I mean, back. I'm like pretty ambivalent about a 100%. Like before the pandemic, I tried to, I consistently had what you might call a haircut or hairstyle.
Yes.
I have only really bicked my head once.
Oh, really?
And that was before I was bald. Oh. It was just because I was bored in college.
Mm, okay.
But I try to, outside of the pandemic, I try and get a haircut. Like I will get a fade once every, you know, 12 days or 15 days so that I feel like I'm doing something.
Is that going to the barber and getting the fade yeah. or is that a home fade? Well,
no, oh. I go to the barber, stop in the barber shop on my way home from dropping the kids off at school, say hi to the guys at Hair Zone.
Where is this geographically?
We're talking about Garvanza, Northeast Los Angeles.
The Hair Zone.
Here's a good name.
People might know it as the Ford v. Ferrari block. It's where they shot most of Ford v. Ferrari that wasn't on the race
track. Very famous block.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just changed the street names around that area to commemorate it.
But with the pandemic, it was the first time I abandoned getting a haircut. So since the pandemic has happened, I happen to have recently bought a good pair of clippers. Mm. And so I just go out in the backyard, set it to number 1/2.
Yeah,
And just go over the top of my head and let the little pieces of hair fall into my garden, which I call feeding the birds.
You feed the birds.
That's interesting. Is there any farming benefit to having follicles in your soil? Or is it just a bunch of DNA that people are going to later on think, like, I think someone was murdered here over and over again. Very hairy person.
I think that's likely what it is. I just want to get in as many government databases as I can.
As humanly possible.
You're laying down some serious archaeological tracks for the future.
But Charlie, do you do it yourself at home? Do you go full shaving cream and a razor, or are you just going over it with a clipper?
I do a clipper. I have a Norelco that I really like. Mm. It's very simple. Mm. I shave it and I throw that hair in my front yard and hope the government doesn't find it. Right. And then I take and then I quote bick it. It's actually a shtick. Mm-hmm. But I
You can start saying shtick it.
That's I shtick it. Yeah, shtick why don't it. I start? Why haven't I started that?
I know. Pretty good shtick this it. Weekend. Yeah, I got some good
yeah.
shtick.
Yeah, so then shtick I'll just shaving cream everything, chop it all
and
off.
Just take hack the whole, at it. Take the whole thing off until you're as soft as a little baby.
Yeah, I don't think I'm ever that soft. I'm a rugged man, but I'm a rugged little baby.
Have you ever, Charlie, used one of those electric shavers that goes over your finger like a finger comb?
I haven't.
It's an electric shaver that Pitbull endorses.
No, I haven't. There's something about it that creeps me out.
How I don't see how that a handheld blade that you don't even use a mirror for the back of your head is less terrifying to you than just
a stick.
Yeah, the thing has been probably tested on a few like lab rats before they sold it.
A couple.
Charlie's
bones.
Like, I try and do it the safe way. I use my Crocodile Dundee knife.
Yeah, that's right. That's
I get in a moving knife. Bus on an off road, trim it away. I love the image. Now, I have a new image of you, Charlie, with a bunch of shaving cream all over your head.
Yeah. No one's really ever seen it. I even hide it from Camille while I do it.
I love it.
Charlie, do you go tip to toe? I mean, what's the downtown situation?
Oh, it's not long at all. It's like 20 minutes. I just do my head. No, I'm an ape underneath my neck.
See, Jesse, you can't resist. You're interviewing. Look at that.
I also keep it tight between the legs. Look, that's not what this show's about.
Oh, I manscape. I do.
Okay, great.
Head and the dick and the balls.
For manscaping, there's sort of like, I guess like what, early 90s manscaping, which was just the full embrace of like, you know, it's full metal jacket haircut style down there. It's just like shorn and probably uncomfortable to your partner. But then Now it's just sort of like making sure it's not very 70s, right?
I just want it not to be 70s. Yeah, yeah. I have a, for that, I have a wall. I can't remember what it's called. It's like a little tiny shaver kind of thingy. And it's particularly for that. And I'll just like manscape my dick and balls so that I'm not repulsive to my wife.
That's a scary one. That one's never...
Oh, it's horrifying. I feel like I'm defusing a bomb.
Yeah.
It doesn't help that your pubes are red, green, and yellow.
Yeah, that's right. I got to pick.
And he, for whatever, he has his third black like ball between his legs.
Why do I have that?
A fuse on it.
I feel like, honestly, I feel like you could get Pitbull on the show if you contacted that Pitbull razor company. That has, you know, side of the bus ads.
That's true.
Yeah, just call the Pitbull head razor people.
Mm-hmm.
Say we want Pit on the show. Call him Pit because that way they know you're comfortable.
Yeah. can we get Pitbull on here?
I think he's within your grasp.
I think so.
Wow, that's a big get.
Well, he also seems like a person who's like, promotion? Yeah, where can I go? Like any platform? I'll go in there and...
I don't care,
I don't care, mate.
I saw a picture of him yesterday, and I was like, oh, yeah, he's bald.
We gotta get P-Stew.
P-Stew? Who's P-Stew?
Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart. Oh, the Pit Stew.
Who's Pit Stew?
Oh, no, this new guy.
You missed the window. Blunt Talk was the window. He's not coming on. He's not Picard. He's too big.
Well, now, yeah, I know. Now he's in Picard land stuff. Yeah,
he's too cool for
he's
us.
He's out in space. So, Jesse, you're bald. And,
that's true.
And you got a great head for it. You got a fantastic shape dome for it. So it's meant to be. But do you think that is sort of like pushed your path towards being behind the hidden a voice in someone's ears as a president?
When I still had hair, I hosted a television show.
Oh, you did? Oh, that's right.
I wonder, I wonder if, you know, right now, honestly, I'm too busy doing family stuff and running a company and hosting three podcasts to like go audition for things or even to go pitch things.
Right.
But my theory is that that my beard is the thing that makes me distinctive looking, which is the secondary category underneath attractive. Like, attractive is your top thing that you could be to be on television.
Totally.
The other is like Guy Fieri, which is distinctive looking.
Right.
Did you say Guy Fieri?
Doing a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I mean, you wouldn't know him without his distinctive look.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the spiky blonde hair. Yeah.
And he's like a medium looking guy. You know, he's neither attractive nor unattractive of the face. You know, he's a regular person you'd see walking down the street, except he's got that ridiculous aesthetic and that puts him over on TV.
I'm now, after this, going to search for Guy Fieri unbleached and find some pictures of just like how...
Oh, have you ever seen it, Huskman?
No, is he just like the most normal looking white dude ever? Yes.
Yes.
I'm sure.
I've done that because I'm obsessed with Guy Fieri.
But, I love
he's just like, yeah, this is what just a people he looks look like a businessman in Santa in Rosa.
Yeah, exactly.
He's from Santa Rosa.
That's great. If he ever goes on the lam, he's like totally set up. He's like,
he'll be safe. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I would say, so is that a conscious, like, I was going to say, your beard and mustache experiments and sort of expression, is that a reaction to not having the hair? Is it just something you're like, yeah, I want something to mess with?
Well, I mean, I think my dad was bald, and he was frankly more handsome than I, but he typically had a beard.
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of fond memories of my dad and his beard.
Yeah.
And, you know, frankly, my beard is less a response in terms of aesthetics to my baldness as it is a response to my weak chin. Like, when I finally grew a beard, I was like, yeah, that hides that pretty well.
Oh, yeah, that gives it some weight and some
yes. Now it's just an undifferentiated mass.
That's hilarious.
I'm so glad you said that as opposed to it's kind of a fuck you to my dad and his beard that I grew up around here. A vengeance beard.
He thought he was so fucking hot.
Walking around.
Early on in the pandemic, I shaved my beard because, you know, there was that thing about you can't fit your mask if you have a big beard. And it upset my children.
Yeah.
My children were sincerely, legitimately upset by it.
Yeah. That's what I've heard from people that
my daughter is now 14 and she's not upset by it, but she'll just be like, what time I had to shave for something and I came out of the bathroom and she just gave me a thumbs down. She's like, nope. Not the right face
like
right now.
Like a literal human emoji of a thumbs completely. Down. That's funny.
But when she was younger, I had to shave just down to a mustache for something. And so we let her see me doing it and let her kind of like take some off. So it wasn't just like,
oh,
dad's been replaced by his evil twin in the 70s sitcom and he's walking back in the room here. You know?
I think Brian, especially in your career, your baldness is a sort of superpower.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it comes up a lot, like it, as far as what you were saying with it being, you know, you're either attractive or distinctive looking or something. It is it with character actors, you sort of have a little bit of a brand
if you have a little facial hair
plugged into it. And so for me, it's a little strange that it's so gray and white now, you know,
the beard,
just because it kind of, unless for each audition, I clumsily try to color it or something, I'm kind of relying on them. Just like, imagine me looking 10 years younger if you put some brown goop on my face.
If you put some brown shit in here.
Yeah. Right. But I do think, like, lately I've been like, well, maybe I'll shave the beard and keep the mustache. But as far as, like, with the baldness, yeah, I've basically looked the same age for 15 years, you know, except for some wrinkling that's starting to show up, but...
Brian, I was meaning to tell you, speaking of Guy Fieri, I watch probably 2 or 3 episodes of Triple D every night before I go to bed. It's like, for whatever reason, it's the show.
That's your melatonin.
It's my melatonin. It turns my mind off and then I can conk out. But I've seen your Taco Bell commercial. Is it Taco Bell?
Yeah. Great product, guys. Listen, terrific. Yeah.
Terrific. Very salty. And is your beard dyed for that? I forget.
It is. They put a little stuff in there.
I thought last night when I saw it, I was like, I mean, I hope you're getting some fucking residuals because they play that shit.
That one I did pro bono. I was like, I really believe
it. You did it for free.
Yeah. Right. I think you guys are doing such
good. They came to you.
Yeah.
You did it on contingency.
I said, if you guys are going to do a taco sandwich, I'm really part of that.
You're just going to go for it.
Yeah, okay. Completely.
Happy that. Well, wow. I would have tried to get some residuals if I were you.
Nah.
When I started going bald, which, you know, I had sort of just started when I hosted the TV show. And if people don't know, I usually don't like to bring it up because it feels kind of braggy. But for 6 months, I hosted a 15-minute television show called The Grid on IFC.
Hold on. 6 months?
Yeah. So it ran in the afternoons, again, for 15 minutes an episode. And
so, yeah, you had
a lot of that money. So,
yeah, 6 month series.
Yeah. So I lived off my, at that time, I lived off my radio money and did not touch the $300 an episode I got to host The Grid. And anyway, that's around when I started going bald. And I told my wife, like, if I'm bald, I'll never be on television. And she's like, hey, what are you talking about? Like, you could totally, because I'm not a character actor. I'm a host of things, if I'm anything, on television.
Right.
And my wife said, no, don't be ridiculous. And I was like, name 3 bald people on television. It was like, maybe Wolf Blitzer's bald? Can't remember.
Nope.
He
has a low beard.
Charlie Sanders for 1 year in 2010.
Yeah. Dr. Phil. Like, it's like, there's a few people with specific expertise qualifications.
And they're also kind of, so there's Dr. Phil, Al Roker. And then there's got to be one, and they're all kind of, unto themselves, they're kind of personalities, you know.
Yeah. The guy that played Coach in the 90s.
Yeah, that's true.
Craig T. Nelson. That's right. Yeah, he was bald.
So your career, okay, so you are from San Francisco, right? And you know Jordan Morris, very funny gentleman, and you're associated with Casper Hauser, the sketch group. Were you part of
that? Brilliant sketch comedy group. I wish. Yeah. So Jordan Morris and I, Jordan is a Well, these days he's an author. He just had his first book published, graphic novel called Bubble.
Ooh,
but he's also television writer and performer sometimes.
Yeah.
And he and I do a comedy show together called Jordan Jesse Go. And I was Jordan's RA in college when I was 19 and he was 18 at UC Santa Cruz on the Performing Arts Hall.
Nice.
Which is sort of like the cool hall,
the fame hall.
You know, different halls have different identities. Ours was like, what if a hall was super cool?
Okay, cool.
So Jordan and I started doing college radio together with a friend of ours named Gene. Jordan eventually graduated and moved down to LA to work in show business, started working in show business pretty much right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed him down to LA maybe 5-ish years later when my wife went to law school. And when we were still in college, you mentioned Casper Hauser. They have a kind of important role in our development in comedy, which is they're this sketch comedy group from San Francisco, and they're really only not famous because they all went to Stanford and have like highly qualified professional jobs.
Yeah. Like, they have security that they're not willing to give up.
One is a medical doctor. Yeah, one is a federal public defender. One is a professor at Stanford. Like, they each have their own.
So they're like the E.E. Cummings of comedy, as far as like, yeah, they sell insurance on the side and write poetry.
Jordan and I saw a show in San Francisco at the place called the Magic Theater that was Casper Hauser, folks that are San Francisco comedians who are still our friends. It was Casper Hauser, Al Madrigal, who later was on The Daily Show, among other things, W. Kamau Bell, who now has a bunch of Emmys,
wow.
Brent Weinbach, a really brilliant stand-up comic, and this sketch group called Casper Hauser. And I think we almost cried. We could not believe Casper Hauser were real because they were so amazingly brilliant. We're like, what the fuck are these people doing in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Because we didn't know that they were doctors. You know what I mean? That they were already making $250,000 a year and didn't need comedy.
You were assuming maybe they're app designers who were just sort of filling in the...
Is there a chance I opened for them in New York? Did they go do a show in New York?
It could be. They've definitely done the UCB in New York.
Yeah, yeah. I think me and Bobby and Eugene the Buffoons opened for them.
Mm, that's cool.
There you go. So they were instant heroes because they're all about like 5-7 years older than us.
Mm-hmm.
And we invited them on our show. They came down to Santa Cruz to do our show. God bless them. Hour and a half drive. While they were in studio, we played a couple of bits that we had, like pre-recorded bits that we had done for the show,
right,
which was even then like a mostly an interview show, but we would do comedy stuff on there sometimes. Mm-hmm. And they said, I think James Richmond of Casper Hauser said to us, oh, do you guys do sketch? And God bless him forever, Jordan said yes. It was not true. We did not.
He ran backstage and started writing.
Yeah. But Jordan said yes. And they said, oh, great. You know, we could get you some stage time in San Francisco if you wanted. And Jordan and I were like, oh, great. Thank you. Yes, that will be wonderful. And then we started a sketch group.
We will bring our fully developed sketch show up to you this week.
Yes. I mean, that really...
just got back from Aspen.
Yeah, that really was what happened. And that was like just before sketch comedy on video on the internet was the thing.
Right.
So we ended up, you know, we flew around playing sketch comedy festivals when we were 22 and 23 and 24 and, you know, wrote a million sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it didn't... like we weren't like on sitcoms because of it, but it was definitely our first time getting paid doing comedy.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a really big deal. I mean, not for the greater world, just for us. Completely ignored by the broader world.
Yeah, no.
One's life was enriched.
But. Yeah. When they're piecing together your murder, they're going to be like, I wonder if this is a sketch comedian. It feels like this hair follicle belongs to a funny guy.
But people who aren't familiar, who are listening to this and aren't familiar with Casper Hauser, should Google Spicy Ponyhead and watch Casper Hauser do their, or listen to on the podcast of theirs I produced, them do their sketch, Spicy Ponyhead, is in my 10 favorite sketches ever of all time.
I love that.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah, I was just curious about it because the San Francisco comedy scene is a very, it feels like it was, it, it was this kind of breeding ground where people would then leave San Francisco to go to New York or LA or whatever, and then sort of get their opportunities or whatever they're jumping off on. But yeah, it always felt like it was that it had a pretty fertile scene and like really, really hyper intelligent scene too, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately in San Francisco, I mean, there certainly are San Francisco comics who are San Francisco comics mm-hmm. for their whole careers. And some, you know, Kamau moved to New York to do his show on FX, Totally Biased. He had a late night show on FX for a couple of years, but he moved back to the Bay Area after that show was done. He still lives in the Bay Area with all his Emmys that he's winning for CNN.
Yeah.
Mostly it is a place where people maybe don't start, although in some cases they do, but at least check in for a few years to figure out what they're doing. And honestly, I think the reason is there aren't talent scouts there. You can't work in show business there mm-hmm. unless you can get a Nash Bridges audition. But
are they still making that?
No, absolutely not.
Only in San Francisco. They just shoot the episodes.
Yeah. It's a local show.
All my theater teachers always just were on Nash Bridges once a year.
Yeah.
And then they would be in like cut scenes for CD-ROM video games. That was like the entire entertainment world of the San Francisco Bay Area was like being in a cutscene.
I've made it, everybody.
In Star Wars X-Wing fighter.
That's so funny.
Or, yeah, but
I went just real fast on the head of our communications department. I went to UNC at Greensboro, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
His bragging rights was that he worked on like Jaws 4 or something.
Uh-huh.
And it was just the one where it's just like, you know, whenever straight to video comes out, this is going straight to video. And but it was, he would always he would tell far more in depth and sort of like, you're gonna want to hear this story about when I worked on Jaws 4.
That's amazing.
And it was one of the reasons I didn't go in the comm department. So I was like, oh man, if this is the biggest,
if that's what ends up happening to you.
Jordan was in the movie All About Steve.
Mm-hmm. I remember All About Steve.
Yes, it was a Sandra Bullock movie that was on the shelf for like 3 years before she won that Oscar, and then they put it out real quick.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, he works in the entertainment industry for real, so he's hesitant to mention that he's in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I am so jealous that he was in it. Like, to me, if you're going to have a movie credit, like, and it's not going to be The Godfather or whatever, of course you want it to be All About Steve. Like, that is, unless it's...
I still remember the cover.
Yeah, unless it's Starship Dave or whatever.
You mean Meet Dave, which I was in?
What's that?
Meet Dave?
That's the one where...
I know it, but I can't totally picture it for some reason.
It is. That's where he is a spaceship, and I was his lieutenant left arm, by the way. No big deal.
So I think the thing about, didn't Kevin Murphy or Bill Corbett from Riff Trax and Mystery Science Theater 3000 write that movie? I think one of those guys wrote
maybe
that movie. Anyway, the thing about San Francisco, I think, is that it's a place with a big appetite for the arts
mm-hmm.
and a lot of well-educated people with great taste, but there's no actual famous people there to draw attention from the people who are working their stuff out.
Yeah.
So when we were doing a little bit of stuff there, it was Al and Kamau and Casper Hauser and Brent Weinbach, who's a total genius. Moshe Kasher was there. Mm. Ali Wong, who's suddenly became a huge star out of nowhere 3 years. I mean, not out of nowhere, out of her brilliant talent.
Right.
But Ali is such a nice, cool lady. She's a San Francisco native.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Kerouac.
Yeah, and then Lawrence Ferlinghetti was there at mm-hmm. the time we were there.
Jerry Garcia
think.
Was part of that scene.
Who else?
Jerry doing some comedy.
Jack London was in Oakland at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Jack London. My dad, Chuck Sanders.
The Golden Gate Bridge was doing some pieces.
You got it. But yeah, I mean, it's like the perfect place because it has like a New York or LA level of appreciation, like sophisticated appreciation for something. Like, there's no room in the San Francisco comedy scene for being racist, for example.
Yeah.
It is a really well integrated scene. So there's people from all different kinds of cultural and ethnic and other kinds of backgrounds that all kind of work together because of the kind of the tone of the bay and also the kind of mediumness of the size of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
We were lucky to know those folks. Like, we weren't intimately involved in that because we were an hour and a half away, but we were lucky to like get to meet Brent Weinbach or right. get to meet, there's, you know, there's a comic from San Francisco named Jasper Red, who I think might be the funniest out of any of those people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe funnier than Kamau and Al and all those folks, you know. And we just, you know, we just got to invite them to Santa Cruz to be on our college radio show. They didn't have anything better.
That's when you kind of like create, and not in a vacuum, like that implies that you're, what you're doing is doesn't serve anything, but like when you create in a space that is free of, like you're saying, the distractions of opportunity or, you know, or whatever of Hollywood itself, but when you're just trying to impress your contemporaries, and then by doing that you are gleaning stuff from them, that's like the best. I mean, yeah. UCB was that way at first, where we were just doing it for each other. You know what I mean?
And then, I think yeah, also the presence of SF Sketchfest, which I think is still probably the best comedy festival the English language, you know, was a big part of that as well. Like, when I graduated from school, I worked for them some. We performed, like, I've performed at Sketchfest every year since I was 22.
Mm-hmm.
You know, first doing our sketch group, Prank the Dean, and then doing Jordan Jesse Go, and now doing Jordan Jesse Go and Judge John Hodgman. You know, I mean, it's a great place to make art.
Yeah.
Like, if there was any show business there, it would be like, I'd probably still live there.
Yeah.
Only on Bald Talk. Oh, Bald Talk.
Then you morphed into this interviewer. Like, was that?
I'll tell you what happened.
Yeah.
Like, there are two key elements to me morphing into interviewer. One was Jordan and Gene and I, and Gene still works in show business. He's a producer on Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't do comedy anymore, but I would say maybe the funniest of the three of us.
Yeah.
The three of us used to try and write. We were scared to talk and be funny. We had an hour a week. We were scared to talk for an hour and try and be funny. So we would try and write an hour's worth of material, like the night before. Like, we would all get together in one or the other of our dorm rooms and just be frantically typing bits and like trying to come up with ideas for contests for people to call in, just anything to fill the time. And I think our first guest, or at least the first one that I remember, was Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar.
Oh yeah.
And Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar, Jordan went to dickdale.net, the official website of Dick Dale, and there was a phone number on the contact section. This was when there were still phone numbers and celebrities' websites.
Yeah.
And Jordan called it, and it was just Dick Dale in his trailer in the desert. And he's like, yeah, I'll come on your show. And so he came on our show, and he told us all about how all the different genres of music he invented. You'd think it would just be surf rock, but there's a number of others as well.
Yeah. He created jazz.
Yes, yeah. It's really. And we were like, oh, well, that filled up half the show.
Ah.
So that was the first thing, was when we realized that an interview could fill half the show.
Oh, you just found a lazy solution to filling time.
That's and <cool. laughs> also that we could trick our comedy heroes into talking to us for mm-hmm. half an hour. Like, you know, I remember Matt Besser was one of the first people who was on the show when the UCB nice. TV show was on. You know, there was an email address on the UCB website, and we sent an email to it, and Matt emailed back.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
and
cool.
And said, yeah, I'd be glad to do it. You know, no problem.
That's,
I'd be,
that's
be
nice.
Glad to do it. So those were the kind of the two things. It's like, we could get our heroes. Like, I almost, when we booked David Cross on the show,
mm-hmm.
I was, I think, a junior in college.
Whoa.
And I think I almost cried. Like, I couldn't believe it was real. Like, we had just been sitting in our dorm room watching these bootleg VHS tapes.
This That's
before
what I
Mr.
did.
Show was on DVD.
Yeah, me
watching
too.
Bootleg VHS tapes exactly. on you know, Extra Play or whatever it's called, where there's like 8 hours of stuff on one VHS tape.
Yeah.
Gene had got them from some bootleg video store in Sherman Oaks, like Larry Sanders' Mr. Show and Tenacious D, and we just watched every episode of all of those over and over,
yeah.
And so when we booked David Cross on the show, it was like, I can't believe this is real. The other thing that happened, that where I became an interviewer, is Gene and Jordan graduated from college and moved to LA to work in show business.
You're abandoned.
And I was still living, I was still living at my mom's house in San Francisco. And I basically said to my, there was a summer where I had people guest host with me because I was so scared to be on mic by myself. And W. Kamau Bell and Al Madrigal both did that. God bless them.
And so this is Casper all, Houser. Sorry to interrupt. This is still through your college? This is still
Jordan's a year younger than me. So the whole year after I graduated from college, I was driving to Santa Cruz once a week in my mom's car to do our college radio show.
I love it.
Then after Jordan graduated, I kept doing that.
Yeah.
Eventually it got to the point where I realized there was no way I was going to be like Harry Shearer, just writing comedy by myself, then doing it by myself to no one on a microphone. Because my worry was that it would end up as funny as Harry Shearer's show is.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent a lot of time working on my Dan Rather impression, so that I felt like I could do a pretty good
up till 2004, that was useful.
Harry Shearer's radio. Oh, Harry Shearer's still doing it, I'm sure.
And, no one stole him.
Yeah. And
he doesn't know.
You guys didn't know this show is just going to be me dragging Harry Shearer, I guess. Legendary voice actor.
The number of times Harry Shearer comes up. Every guest has something to say about it.
Every guest has something to say.
But I was like, I can't do comedy by myself. Like, I can't write comedy by myself. Like, me and Jordan sometimes would write sketches ourselves, but we at least rewrite each other's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I was like, I can't talk to myself. I can't get enough people to call for it to be a call-in show. So I guess it's an interview show now.
Yeah.
Like previously that was like half, 2/3 of what we were doing. And I was just like, now it's all interviews.
I love people's origin stories, and I love how many performers, where they end up is never an intentional landing. You know what I mean? No, in the best way.
No. Almost never.
Almost never. And I mean, the one,
one also, like one out of 100 lands where they plan to land.
I'm going
to
be there.
Brian, I left out one thing about my origin story, which is I also received an experimental super soldier serum.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's not.
So that was also a big part of it. I had been sort of a weakling before. I became really strong.
That doesn't necessarily, that, I mean, is that what made you go bald? Because otherwise, I don't see how it pertains to any of this.
Yeah, it did. I mean,
you get strong, but you go bald. It's testosterone.
Is that it?
Yeah. And what they call mask musk.
It just like exploded out of your hair. All right. Well, this is, because it's so funny, like even earlier you were sort of like a little self-deprecating about the, you know, that you have a career as an interviewer. But I, like with Bullseye is a for real national interview show. You know what I mean?
It's a real NPR show.
It's a real NPR show.
I am the proud host of NPR's least successful show.
Well, what does that mean?
When you finally, Brian, get that taste of that Thistle and Shamrock level success in public radio.
When part of what they do pay you is tote bags from 2 years
finally,
ago.
When you're like, drive. I'm finally marginally more successful than Bird Note.
They pay you in tote bags.
It's still, I mean, I don't know. It's cool. And you also have the Go Team as your theme song, which is one of my favorite. That song is one of my favorite songs on earth. And every time I hear it, I'm like, I love that song so much.
I still can't believe they let me use that. Like I emailed them. Like another one. I just emailed, like so much of the, to be frank, like so much of the modest success that I have had has to do with the fact that, I can write a coherent and credible seeming email.
Mm-hmm.
like my credibility is very marginal in real life, but I can really buff it up in 3 paragraphs.
You should do a class at UC Santa Cruz about writing a good email.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I took a class at UC Santa Cruz called Working in Film and Television. And God bless this man who had been a Santa Cruz graduate, taught this
class. Step one, get on Nash Bridges, no matter what you do.
Well, like there were, we had classmates that year who were on MTV as an MTV fraternity life show.
Oh, no.
Who had started a frat at Santa Cruz. There were no frats at Santa Cruz other than like an Asian American.
They started them to be on TV.
Yeah, there was like an Asian American frat and an African American frat, neither of which were like residential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just like a, you know, it was like the Black Engineers Association type
right.
deal.
They'd have a lunch.
And those were the only fraternities at Santa Cruz until they started one to get on fraternity life. And on the show, they stole some koi from a koi pond by my dorm room. And it turns out the koi were worth like $10,000 each.
Oh, no.
And they went to jail.
That's amazing.
they went to jail for like a year.
Oh, wow.
Wow. I feel bad
anyway,
for the koi.
In this working in film and television class, I remember two things about it. It was UC Santa Cruz alumni who worked in film and television. So the people were really kind to come from LA and do guest lectures. Every week it was a different guest lecture. They were really nice people to do this. And, you know, we learned about what it's like to operate a camera on the television news in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two people who were very successful who I remember. One is the guy who taught the class, and he had been a psychologist, but then he invented the knob that you turn to show whether you like something or don't like something in a focus group of a television show.
Wow.
Focus group knob maker.
Focus group knob inventor.
That was one of the top entertainment accomplishments. And then the other one was this guy who cut trailers and did movie marketing. And he, again, very nice, very successful, didn't need to come talk to us, but he did. But the thing that I remember was he was talking about how anyone can sell a great movie, but a less good movie is a lot harder. And he's talked about how the movie Kangaroo Jack was on the shelf. Like they couldn't figure out what to do with Kangaroo Jack, which was like, it was basically like an R-rated action comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this guy's idea to take it down to PG-13 by cutting some swears and like some blood, and then focus on this one fantasy sequence where somebody gets like knocked upside the head and imagines a talking kangaroo,
mm-hmm.
build all the marketing around that talking kangaroo, and pretend that it was a children's film about a talking kangaroo, when in fact that was just one tiny scene from the movie where Anthony Anderson was unconscious or something.
Oh my God.
And all I remember is just asking him, so does that mean that you came up with the slogan, he took the money and he's not giving it back? And he's like, I sure did. And I'm like, well, I mean, isn't that what taking it is? Like, why would he give it back? And he's like, sometimes you do what you got to do.
And like, I came okay. up with that saying too.
Yeah.
I feel like the slogan is, you always do what you got to do.
Yeah. But Jordan, like when Jordan went to the Career Center and said he wanted to work in film and TV because he didn't have any connections or anything, they literally gave him the email address of a guy who was the camera operator on the local news in San Jose.
Wow.
That was the top entertainment industry alumnus
yeah.
of UC Santa Cruz. That's at the insane. Time.
Doesn't Jonathan Franzen teach at Santa Cruz?
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Have you ever taken his class?
He didn't when we were there, but I did take a class from Tom Lehrer, the
cool.
comic songwriter, which was pretty sweet.
It
was a class on American musical theater, and he's still alive. He's in his 90s now.
Damn.
But he was already 80-ish. And the thing that I remember him saying is that since, like, I don't remember what the cutoff was. It was in the 50s. Like, since Jerome Kern or something like that, there were only two songwriters he liked. They were Stephen Sondheim and Randy Newman.
I was going to say Randy like, Newman. I knew it would be Randy yeah. Newman.
And I was like, yeah, Stephen Sondheim and Randy Newman. Not bad choices if you're Tom Lehrer.
Yeah,
completely. You pretty much, I don't know who else you would like if you were Tom Lehrer.
Yeah, that's his, check out his Google searches. That's all he's on there. That's all he's going for.
I mean, primarily interested in complicated rhyme schemes and jokes in songs. Yeah. So that's your top two.
Weirdly joyous but passive aggressive songwriters from Andy Newman.
Just a weird cold edge at the back of it.
He's such a baffling.
I love him, but he is baffling.
It's such a
talking about the Noom?
The new man. The new man. Himself.
I had him on Bullseye.
Oh yeah,
I had Randy Newman. Wow, that was like cool. That was one of my like absolute, you know, white whale dream bookings.
Was he cool?
He was wonderful.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, that's nice.
So cool.
I love a
Jordan
good
and I
report.
Jordan and I went to see him perform in San Francisco when we were 23, at this club called Bimbo's. Bimbo's 365, and
all year round, just Bimbo's.
Yeah, it was a little, you know, it was a little show. There was maybe 300 people, you know, like cabaret style. And the thing that I remember the most is, you know, he mostly sings his, you know, he sings Marie or whatever. He sings his moving, you know, beautiful songs, and you know, a few of his famous funny songs. But he has to sing the Pixar songs too.
I got a friend in you.
And yeah, so he sang You've Got a Friend in Me.
Oh, that version of it. I've got a friend in you.
I've got a friend in you. I like that.
You
better,
are my
actually.
Friend near me.
You like me for stuff I do.
I've got a friend in me is the one that I sang in college a lot, folks.
Wow, that says a lot about me more than anything else.
Experimenting. Randy Newman played You've Got a Friend in Me, and then at the end of it, he just went, of course, it's all bullshit, isn't it?
Oh, that's great.
It was great. Oh. But, like, when I had him on Bullseye, I asked him about writing those Pixar songs, and, like, I think those Pixar songs are really great.
Yeah.
Like,
they're totally good songs, yeah, for sure.
And he said, like, one of the greatest pleasures in his life was to write a song as a job.
Mm.
He's like, what better enjoyment could there be for a professional working artist than to have someone give you a problem to solve and you have to do it and do a good job?
Yeah.
And like, it makes sense. You know, every member of his family essentially was a celebrated film composer.
Oh,
he's like, yeah, his uncle was like maybe one of the most legendary ever. And it was like, yeah, I like working for a living and that is my job. So of course I love it. When you think he's going to say like, no, my real art is writing Sail Away, you know, like my real art is writing a grand orchestral, beautiful song that's from the perspective of a slave owner. That's an inversion of Amazing Grace. If the guy who wrote Amazing Grace had never repented,
But that's harder to say to people at parties, so it's just easier.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just like, oh, yeah, so I wrote the songs for James and the Giant Peach. Mm-hmm.
There is something to just to point to that, like, professionalism, like, for you to have the skill set of, like, yeah, maybe he is misanthropic or he has, like, a little, you know, sort of edge at the end of him, but he's like, no, I can put myself in the perspective of true sort of, like an earnest expression or, you know, to speak to children, you know, even.
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about Randy Newman, like you think the funniest funny one for me is this one called My Life is Good, which is basically him singing about how great his life is and how great it is to be rich and live in Los Angeles and like about how hot the moms are at his kid's school and how he's friends with Bruce Springsteen.
God.
There's this part in there where he's like, we're hanging around talking about some new guitars or something. And he says, Bruce Springsteen says to him in the song, he says, Ran, I'm tired. Will you be the boss for a while?
Wow.
So there's like funny ones, but like, but you know, I mean, the theme from The Natural,
yeah,
like, bum, 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 bum. Mm-hmm. Like that's the most nakedly emotional,
yeah,
like no irony, grand, beautiful, or like, I think it's going to rain today. Like there's a reason that like Nina Simone recorded that song.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it is one of the most amazing songs about being sad.
Yeah.
You know, So anyway, yeah. This is Randy Newman talking to me, Jesse Thorne.
Yeah, that's our new podcast, the spinoff.
Yeah,
yeah, we were going to do Mention Harry Shearer, but now we're going to do this one. But we can still do Mention Harry Shearer.
We'll
as
do
a podcast.
Both of them. Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of sincerity, and I hope you're not sick of this question, but I found this fascinating, the new sincerity that you are associated with. So if I can try to clumsily sort of like set it up. So. Sure. New sincerity is a cultural movement defined by sort of like doing away with irony and doing away with sort of like a caustic approach to things and then approaching it more from a celebration of joy, sort of rejects irony and an ironic sort of like appreciation of cultural things. Is that anywhere near it?
That's most of it.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, I just want to clarify. Because this is so profoundly associated with me, because it's been in my Wikipedia page since I was 25,
right.
I do want to clarify that it is a goof I thought of in college, but it's not an insincere goof.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what happened is me and Gene and Jordan used to sit together in the college dining hall, and we had this wonderful friend named Rebecca Wirth. And one day Rebecca said, "It makes me nervous when I sit with you guys." And we said, "Why is that, Rebecca?" Because we probably all had a crush on Rebecca, among other things. Mm-hmm. She was a really cool lady, is a really cool lady. And she said, "Oh, because I can never tell whether you're joking or not."
Mm.
And we all kind of thought about it and realized that we both were and were not joking. Like, we were talking about things that were funny to us, but we weren't, like, being insincere.
Right.
Like, we were maybe being a little ridiculous, but not insincere. And I think when we codified it, or I codified it, I wrote some essays for the show back in the day.
Was this for Bullseye?
Oh, that's what I thought you were going to ask, if that's what I won the Pulitzer for, and it is. this was on Bullseye. It used to be called the San Diego America.
Right.
And was like one of the things that actually made me and Hodgman friends, because he came on the show and then heard the essays and liked them.
Mm-hmm.
But basically the idea of it was, you know, we grew up, we're all what they call elder millennials, and we kind of grew up in the shadow of Gen X. And Gen X's cultural position was mostly about rejecting boomers and being disaffected, like a kind of distance from everything and a kind of too cool for school attitude, too cool to try at things. You know, Ethan Hawke is the good one in Reality Bites and not Ben Stiller, the one who actually likes her and does stuff for her.
Mm.
Obviously, I'm painting with a very broad brush, but like, I think as we saw it as 19-year-olds, we basically saw Gen X as being people talking about characters from later Planet of the Apes films and like rolling their eyes, or like people being ironic about Gilligan's Island or something like mm-hmm. that. That was fine and important, but it wasn't necessarily for us. And I think later on, there was this kind of hyper sincerity of like, you know, washboard bands and hay bales at weddings.
Right, artisan ice is being made and stuff like that.
Yeah, which is not necessarily, I mean, I think all of that was pretty good overall, mm-hmm. but it definitely wasn't totally our thing. What the new sincerity more was things that could not be taken in literally because they were too much. Things that were grand or huge or absurd or ridiculous, but also were not bad for having been those things.
Can you give an example? Because
I can.
Okay.
Like Dolly Parton.
Okay.
Like Dolly Parton is an insane cartoon character,
mm-hmm.
an intentionally insane cartoon character. She's not self-aware. She knows that she turned her life into this absurd thing. She's also, you know, one of the 10 greatest American singers of the 20th century and a genius songwriter.
Right.
You know, her ridiculousness does not make her like it. Dolly Parton will never be cool in the way that Miles Davis is cool. She's very hot. She's pushing her thing
mm-hmm.
hard, but her thing is legitimately amazing. Like, you can laugh at Dolly Parton as Dolly Parton does. Like, she thinks it's funny. Like, she thinks being Dolly Parton is funny. But she also, you know, wrote some of the greatest songs of the 20th century and is a singer without parallel.
The interesting thing, like, bringing her up makes me think, because right now I feel like that she is a bit of a current culture icon for 20-somethings in a way that is, her ridiculousness has sort of like its ownership, you know. Right. She's positioned in this way that she's like, she's not this kind of like bigger than life, like, you know, like caricature. She, I think, to these younger fans who are now discovering and stuff, that she's genuine. Like, there's a genuineness.
Yeah.
In,
yeah, I like her just the way,
yeah,
she
so
is.
It's interesting.
That's not my interpretation.
Yeah. And so I this whole concept was very fascinating to me, because from where it, you know, Wikipedia, which is like the be all and end all of all information, but they had mentioned that there was a Nude Sincerity sort of band movement in the, that came out of Austin, Texas, and from 85 to 90. And then it sort of was picked up later with bands like Cat Power was associated with it. And it was just an interesting, and then David Foster Wallace, someone wrote an essay, sort of identified his expression of that. So I think it's an interesting sort of just like,
yeah. Dave Eggers wrote a great piece. I mean, these are things that I read after Rebecca named it the New Sincerity, but like,
oh, wow.
When we thought of these things, it was before we had read any of these things. Yeah. Or anything. And obviously we still don't know anything about philosophy,
but it comes from a place of reaction, right? Like,
yeah. Dave Eggers wrote a great thing about the death of camp. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, I think camp is probably the closest cultural idea. Like, I would say that the kind of ironic part of camp is, like, the best of the ironic part of camp is something like maybe the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Mm-hmm.
Where it is, I mean, it's a beautiful alternative cultural expression, like that the fans are creating this art out of this art that existed, and it, you know, represents people that aren't represented, and they kind of show themselves in the context of the performance that associates with the thing, and blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah, blah. Ultimately, maybe the actual work of art is more of a I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, more of a vessel for that fan expression than it is a great thing in and of itself.
Right.
I would say the closer kind of camp to the New Sincerity would be like, I watched early in the pandemic, I watched for the first time Liza with a Z, the Liza Minnelli special. Mm-hmm. From the, I guess it's the early 70s. And it's just a song and dance special with Liza Minnelli. And as a person of my age, like, I really only knew Liza Minnelli as something that, like, middle-aged gay guys in San Francisco were into. Mm-hmm. Like, I really didn't know anything about Liza Minnelli other than that and, like, you know, Arrested Development.
Yeah.
You never saw Cabaret?
I never saw Cabaret.
Oh, shit. Cabaret's great.
And she was very funny on Arrested Development. She was great on Arrested Development.
Yeah.
I watched Liza with a Z, and I was like, oh, the reason all those middle-aged gay guys loved her was not because she was Judy Garland's daughter, although I'm sure that helped. It was because she was unbelievably fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. The level of genius in her. And it is, even then, when she was at the height of her power, a kind of mad genius. Like,
yeah.
Its unhingedness, its absurdity, and humor is part of what makes it so great. Like, and it's not that you think that, it's not that you roll your eyes at it. It's that you have to kind of, like, open yourself extra to it, to accept it, because it's so extra. You know, like, you really have to, like, you're like, this is a big thing,
mm-hmm.
but it is supported in that, in so doing. You know what I mean? Like, she backs it up.
Yeah. I love that concept, because it does sort of feel like ever, you know, it, since the 90s, we're always, there's always some counterposition to popular culture that is always going to sort of like comment on where we just were or where we are presently. And I guess this is sort of like,
I also, by the way, if anyone's listening to this, do not wish to defend this. Mostly we just thought it would be fun to have a manifesto.
Yeah, that's great. Like, well, that's, I mean,
it's funny if we had a,
that's, yeah, I mean,
Dada, everybody needs one.
Every, you know, Dadaism started out as just sort of like, oh, this is ridiculous. Let's do this thing. And they wrote up a big manifesto and they're like, oh, you mean this new art movement? Like, sure. All right. You fell for it. Yeah. Let's go for it.
Absolutely.
Man. Well, listen, I know that you just sort of ended up being an interviewer and you're stuck with this and, you know, you're bald. So you really are stuck with it. You are bald.
Taking your hair.
That's what's going to happen. But it was a pleasure to get to ask questions of you for a change. And really.
Yeah, that was fun.
Really give you a break from the question marks because I know it's exhausting. I know it gets really.
Thanks, guys.
We were glad to let you talk. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an honor to be on your show. And Brian, I probably told you this, but my wife, who I started dating when we were seniors in high school, went to college at Sarah Lawrence in Bronxville, New York.
Yeah.
And I would be very lonely in Santa Cruz without my wife. And I would fly to New York and visit her in Bronxville. And we would go to the UCB theater and go to the, it was the one that was long and skinny and had a lot of poles.
Oh, yeah, and the Gristini's, yeah, the one on 26th Street.
Yeah.
The performers that I remember most vividly are you and Seth Morris.
Nice.
And yes. We so admired you guys and it was so artistically meaningful to us.
Aww.
So.
Oh, that means so much to me. Thanks, man. That makes me feel good.
That's the truth.
Very
cool.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thank you. And thank your wife. Thanks for going to a relationship with her wife so that you had the opportunity to encounter me.
To see you.
And I also, like, I just want to say that the other thing is just, like, I had the same kind of feeling and reaction to when you did those Rapping Dad commercials.
The swagger wagon.
About the minivan. Like, it was the same
thing.
You
gotta make a living.
It just moved me so deeply.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, oh, dad. Like, I was a dad by then, and I didn't really have role models.
Yeah.
I was just like, well, if Brian's there and he can rap and just really love that Toyota Sienna.
Oh, listen. Again, if I just want to bring it back to Taco Bell.
That's acting.
And Toyota. If it's about anything, it's about corporate endorsements.
That's acting, baby. That's what you got to do sometimes.
All right, Charles. Well, why don't you promote our little podcast with this wrap up?
Okay, cool. Thanks for listening, Baldies and Harrows. That was Jesse Thorne. You can follow us on Instagram at Bald Talk Pod on Instagram. Download, subscribe, rate, review, listen, enjoy wherever you get your podcasts.
And then after that, head over to Twitter where we are at Bald Talk Podcast, and we will do largely the same thing we're doing on Instagram, but with a little fewer visuals.
Yeah, with less people.
Yeah, fewer followers. Watch. And less interest on our part. That's it. Shave your head, start a talk show. Bye, y'all.
Someone to talk to. Brian and Charlie have a hairless party, and they are all there to invite you. No hairdos, no shampoos, interviews, only on Bald Talk.
Screw it, we're just gonna talk about
comics.
Do you like comic books?
Do you like brothers?
Do you like brothers talking about comic books?
Then this is the podcast for you. Screw it. We're just going to talk about comics.
Will Hines and Kevin Hines, performers from the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and actual brothers, talk about actual comic books they love, like Spider-Man, The Fantastic Four, and many more.
If you prefer your podcast to be about fictional people talking about fictional books, this isn't it. But otherwise...
Screw it. We're just going to talk about comics from Campfire Media.
Campfire.